You're listening to The Radiator, 105.9 FM, WOMM LP, Burlington, Vermont. Today is Monday, December 14th. I'm Shayla Shapiro, and this is Write the Book, the show for writers and curious readers. Write the Book features interviews with authors, poets, illustrators, agents, and editors. Today on Write the Book, you'll hear an interview with Deborah S. Shapiro, editor and publisher of Edible Green Mountains, a quarterly publication that celebrates the culinary heritage of Vermont. Deborah has over 20 years of marketing, communications, and business experience with for-profit and not-for-profit organizations. She has held senior management positions within Fortune 1000 corporations. She does consulting work with a focus on motivating business people to accomplish their goals and achieve insights into themselves, their competition, and one another. Deborah has taught at Champlain College, Washington University in St. Louis, Webster University, and Boston College, in addition to lecturing at the Public Communications Institute at Boston University. She serves on the board of the Stern Center for Language and Learning and was chair of their Strategic Planning Initiative. She's active with the Vermont Fresh Network, working both in fundraising and on the planning committee for their annual forum. Deborah is a tour guide and volunteer at Shelburne Farms. In her previous hometowns of St. Louis and Philadelphia, Deborah worked for a variety of groups serving healthcare, women's causes, and the arts. A graduate of Boston and Cornell Universities, Deborah holds a Master's of Science in Communications and a Bachelor of Arts degree in Political Theory. She has lived in Burlington for 5 years and has been the editor of Edible Green Mountains since its inception in 2007. When Deborah and I sat down to talk last week, I first asked her about her background.
My background is really in communications. I went to graduate school for communications and did a magazine project. I think the name of my magazine was Allure or something. It had a French connection because I was very interested in French at that time. And I did a project about magazines, never thinking I'd have a career in one, but always really enjoying it. And then I left graduate school and worked for McDonald's restaurants, which is rather ironic now that I'm in such a sustainable and conscious state about food. And then I worked for a lot of different organizations in the role of a PR person or marketing person, became a vice president of corporate communications for some corporations, and then worked for a nonprofit and eventually found my way to Vermont through my husband's work and thought, well, now I can finally mesh this passion for communicating with this passion for food, and really had no idea how that would happen.
Yeah.
And then eventually was introduced to Edible Communities.
All right, great. So how did Edible Green Mountains come about?
We were in Portland, Oregon for a wedding. And I remember walking around Portland and going in and out of a lot of different stores and seeing this beautiful publication, and it was called Edible Portland. And I looked through it and I thought to myself, this would be so incredible in Vermont, but I wouldn't know the first thing about how to start a magazine. And at the time, I was teaching at Champlain College, so I had a reason not to get too engaged in that whole process. And I sort of kept the pile of info that we had brought back from Portland, and it sort of sat over there and once in a while beckoned to me, but I let that go. And then there's an organization called the Vermont Fresh Network, which is pretty popular here, and I was working with them on marketing their forum, and they, at a meeting that we had, someone said, you know, we could go to Edible Boston for PR, and I thought, Edible Boston, Edible Portland, is there some connection? And so that sort of began my whole interest and search into the thing, and I Googled and found their website and noticed that they had a listing of areas that they were interested in starting a magazine. So at that point I discovered that Edible Communities was an organization that was starting these magazines around the country. Mm-hmm. And they were looking for people to invest as the publisher, and you received the licensing and servicing rights, for a technical term, to publish the magazine in your state or your community. So I own the rights for the state of Vermont.
Okay.
And so that's sort of how it came about. I spent the whole weekend, because I found all this on a Friday, and it was too late to call. They were on the West Coast. And I remember walking around and thinking, I hope nobody has Vermont. I hope nobody has Vermont. And so it worked out, and I was able to become the publisher for Vermont.
Now, Edible Communities, do they offer you financing or support in any way?
They do offer different options so that you can finance, or there's a bit of an incentive if you put a little more up front. Mm-hmm. They offer you now even more, I think, than they offered when I started. I like to think of myself as sort of the middle group. There was certainly the entrepreneurial, we're all entrepreneurial, but the real entrepreneur pioneers who were maybe the first 10 or 15 publications. I was in the second group of 10 or 15 publications, and by then they had formalized things a bit. We had a visit with Carol Topalian, who's one of the co-founders, and she came. She's an incredible photographer, and that's part of the beauty of the magazines, really, I think, is their imagery and photography, and that's really a credit to Carol and then to her partner, Tracy, who's the acting CEO and marketing brain behind all of this, and together they created this whole feeling. So Carol comes out, takes about 1,000 photos of the area. You have access to all of those. They do have relationships with printing resources and designers and different folks to get you started. They're sort of like the training wheels.
Mm-hmm.
I found for us in Vermont, there wasn't quite as much application as there might be in other places. There weren't an overwhelming number of winter photos, for example. So we went out and were able to get our own, and that started us doing our own photography. I also found that in Vermont, local first really matters, mm-hmm. and I realized that one way to be very distinctive is to make sure that pretty much every penny that goes into this magazine stays in the state. So early on, I found a local designer, Serena Fox, who's been terrific, a local printer, Queen City Printers, and I can say with pride that pretty much every penny stays in Vermont, working with local writers and so forth.
And then do you have design requirements that are set by Edible Communities?
Is there a
template that they...
Yes, you'd notice, I say we sort of look like children of the same parents, you know, from the same family, but no identical twins.
Uh-huh.
So you'll notice our Edible typeface is consistent, the way Edible is. Our mastheads are somewhat different, but it's always in that top portion. And there's certain features we all share, and our websites are all fairly consistent, and mm-hmm. there's a definite intention and commitment to sort of keep this as a branded enterprise, because the goal of Edible Communities is to find opportunities for national advertisers who can find relevance in all of our markets.
Okay. Now, I took this off your website. Edible Green Mountains is for people who are interested in eating and growing delicious, locally produced seasonal foods, getting to know the people who grow, produce, cook, sell, and serve those foods, discovering great dining, day trips, wine, beer, and spirit makers, food events, festivals, books to read, and products to savor. So that seems to sum up is that a mission statement?
In a way. I mean, I think the mission is really the celebrating the culinary abundance, which is sort of under our tagline. And I think a lot about that, because I think food's a topic that's become so controversial and political.
Mm-hmm.
And there are people that are much more informed and much more comfortable than I am with the political aspect of it. So what I'm trying very hard to do is the celebrate part. I don't want to be fluffy. We're not reprinting press releases. We do research. I think we have wonderful reporting and strong editorial. But the idea is to really show the different sides and aspects of something. There's certain topics we haven't delved into yet, raw milk, for example.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm sort of preparing myself for those, because those, I think, are going to require maybe not taking a stand, but really showing some sides of things that are a little bit more emotional and charged for people.
Mm-hmm.
But so I think it's sort of an elaborated part of a mission statement.
Okay. And when you make decisions about the articles that you're going to focus on in the next issue or in the next year, how far in advance do you plan?
Initially, I didn't get very far. Now I can actually say that I think I've gotten a hang of it now. And so now I can say that we actually have people working on stories this winter for next winter.
Oh,
and
wow.
It makes things work a lot better when they can go out and actually take a photo of something in the late season and be able to use it that way. So mm-hmm. I have someone who did they're working on a heritage turkey story for me. And so this year they prepared those turkeys for the holidays and that type of thing.
Okay.
So I'm getting a little better at it. And then there's always some room, though, to have something in there that's unexpected or new.
Mm-hmm.
It's a little bit challenging because we're really not a news publication, and yet you want to remain timely.
Mm-hmm.
So you try to think of those topics that will sort of have an enduring quality. You know, there's only so many of those.
Right.
I think.
Right. You have some regular features.
Mm-hmm.
There's your editorial statement, and then there are you've got a list of producers. Is that
we have
a directory?
We do have a directory, and that's basically built on the folks that advertise with us or people that we feature, and that's been growing in a nice way. And then we have our notable edibles, which that's where we try to. Those things may be something that in the future we get a bigger story or be part of a bigger story, but they're things that you sort of hope somebody may, not everybody might not know about. And so it's a way to...
So you're putting a spotlight on a local producer,
yeah,
or somebody who's...
And the best compliment is when somebody who's in the world of food will run up to me and say, thank you so much for telling me about that incredible nougat, that Vedelmalkur nougat. I never even knew it was out there, or... So I'm hoping to do that. It's getting harder and harder, because with the web, people can really beat you too.
Oh.
Yeah, but there's such immediacy to that.
Right, but you're another resource for people that maybe aren't looking at all the same places.
True. So, yeah. I think that's true.
Yeah. What's your job like?
I work from home.
Mm-hmm.
So having come from the background you asked about earlier, where I had fairly disciplined environments to go into, It's most challenging, I think, to create discipline around working on your own. So it has a lot of ebbs and flows. It doesn't have the consistency that other mm-hmm. types of work have had. So right now we're in the midst of putting the winter issue together. So today my job is all about laying all the pages out on the floor, getting all the ads cut out and sized so that I can see what they look like. Our designer, Serena Fox, that I mentioned, does an incredible job of putting the issue together graphically, but I feel very strongly about where the ads are placed, trying not to put competitors next to one another, wanting it to look nice visually if there's a color that works well with a color in a photograph that's part of the editorial, trying to make people look good.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's what I'm doing at the moment. And then at other times, I'm talking to writers, giving them some initial coaching. I work with some other editors. Andrea Chessman copy edits for us. A wonderful woman who's just started working with me, Janet Hubbard Brown, does a great job at editing and line editing. I'm learning a lot about editing. There's so many levels of editing. It sort of depends on the person where I am in the process, but I'm definitely not the grammar queen, so I don't play that role. I pass that off, but I try to coach people. I like to coach writers and bring a little out of them and ask them some questions, so that's part of the job. Selling ads is part of the job. Finding people to support the magazine, it's supported and it's not for sale unless you want to subscribe. There's a little bit of a question from the community about, well, wait a minute, if it's free, why would I subscribe? And like any commodity, there's a limited number, so if you want to be sure you get it and you want to support the work we're doing, you might choose to subscribe,
mm-hmm.
but it is also free. So the advertisers are key. Without them, we couldn't exist. We wouldn't have Edible Green Mountains. So I work on that. And then I distribute some of them. We have a great distributor, PP&D, which is Professional Postering and Distribution. So Bill Orleans is my distributor, but once in a while I'm going somewhere he's not in the southern part of the state and I'll bring a box. And so as you might imagine, it's sort of jack of all trades.
So when you distribute the publication, where do you take it? Like what places do you
We're
take it?
We're at Healthy Living, City Market in the Chittenden County area, places like that, the Shelburne Farms Welcome Center. Then you'll find us at any of our advertisers. The way the model is supposed to work and what I'm working toward is that the folks who advertise get the benefit of being your distributor. So that's an added incentive for them. So that I'd love to get to the point where I can put on the website or even have a page in the magazine that says, here's where to find us. Anybody who, like, this directory is basically a guide to where we are, because that's how you should be able to get us.
Okay. Early on, you mentioned that it was ironic that you used to work for McDonald's.
Mm-hmm.
And now it makes me wonder, thinking about who might step up to be an advertiser, do you ever have to turn anybody away because they don't necessarily share Edible Green Mountains' vision?
Mm-hmm. We haven't had to. I'd like to think the way, and I've thought a lot about that, like what would happen if one of our large supermarket chains, for example, wanted to come and advertise. And in some ways it would be nice if that would happen. They are selling a lot more local product. And I'm not exactly sure where it would, I guess one of the phrases people like around here is sugar off, right? I'm not exactly mm-hmm. sure where we would be with that. I mean, I think, I don't feel that we're a rabidly locavore publication. So there's certain, if someone wanted to advertise olive oil from California, I wouldn't necessarily turn that away because we can't grow olives here and we don't make our own olive oil and it's certainly closer than Italy. I mean, I think it's more about the values and ethics of the business mm-hmm. and fitting in with what I think are appropriate values and ethics and business practices. So far we really haven't had to turn anyone away. I think advertisers are pretty savvy.
Yeah.
And there's a saying I have, winners know what games not to play. I think they sort of know what field not to get into because it may not really meet their needs.
Right. Who are your writers? Do you ever publish the work of somebody who just sent you something, or do you assign everything? Do you always work with the same people?
I'm open to all types of people and writers. I want to use this opportunity to apologize to anyone listening to this who I didn't respond to immediately. I do get a lot of emails and communication, and I have this little phrase that I'd like to associate with myself, which is that I can be relied upon for meaningful communication, because I feel so much of today's communication isn't relevant or meaningful. That means that I spend way too much time thinking about what to say. So instead of writing back and saying, thanks so much for your query, we'll be back to you, I try to actually read their query and say something about it, and that takes a little more time. But I do get a lot of solicitations. I find that there are some writers I work with consistently. Catherine Quimby Johnson, Andrea Chessman writes mm-hmm. for us each issue. Devin Carnes, a great young writer. Melissa Meese contributes for us, and I apologize for anyone I'm forgetting. I've really loved everyone I've worked with, and it's just a matter of there's only so much space and only so many topics. So once in a while I'll get a query, like when we had the Kefir, I think is how you mm-hmm. actually mm-hmm. do pronounce it, piece. That was something that came to me that I hadn't really thought about assigning, and this person, Mary Lou Ricoeur, had a great approach to that. And she also has done a wonderful story for us on beans. She comes up with a lot of unique ideas. There's actually one I won't give away that you'll probably see in a future story.
Edible Green Mountains is working on its 11th issue, is that right?
Our 10th. Winter will be our 10th.
Okay.
Winter will be our 10th issue.
So can you name a few stories from past issues that have been favorites for you?
A few stories that have been favorites for me. Well, I love... Now, I didn't mention Christopher Couton. Christopher Couton writes what I consider an opus. So she did that incredible heirloom tomato story. Mm-hmm. And here's sort of an interesting story, the irony of publishing, right? So we come out in the summer of 2009, beautiful tomato on the cover, taken by Carol Topalian. Beautiful story about tomatoes, everything you'd want to know about heirlooms, expertly edited by Andrea Chessman. And then what happened? We all know, right? We have the tomato blight. So that was really a tough one.
It was bad.
And it's an issue that I hope people will keep around and hold very near and dear. I also really love Alaire Diamond's writing. She did this wonderful story. Anyone who has our Spring 09 issue with the beautiful eggs on the mm-hmm. cover, she did a beautiful story about the artistic things that are made, the crafty things that are made that have a relationship to food. And when you asked about how I meet my writers, we both had gone to hear Michael Pollan speak when he was at UVM. Mm-hmm. And I actually, here's some true confessions, there was a big line and I had a bunch of the magazines with me, but I thought, oh, I'm just not going to stand in line. And I left. And I called my husband from the car and he said, so did you meet him? Did you go give him the magazine? Did you meet him? And I said, no, And so he encouraged me, champion that he is, he encouraged me to go back inside. And I think it was really meant to be, because there I was standing in line. I desperately, like many women do, frequently throughout the day, had to run to the ladies' room and asked this woman to hold my place. And she said, sure, if you'll do the same for me. That turned out to be Alaire Diamond, who's a field naturalist and was getting her, I believe, PhD at UVM, if I'm not mistaken. And so we got to talking about her work, and I said, you know, I would love to have a story about baskets, because she was telling me about this woman who takes this ash tree every year, cuts it down pretty soon, it'll be in the winter months of the year, cuts down this ash tree and makes these incredible baskets that have sort of this historic relevance to the way they're used for food. There's a fiddlehead basket so that all the right things fall through the holes, and of course an egg basket. And so that's definitely been a very special story. I mean, they're all really special. I mean, I laugh. Andrea always writes something with a great sense of humor. We were going to call her our fat foods editor because she wrote about cider donuts and she wrote about poutine, and she has a story coming out in the winter issue about pie for breakfast. So
great.
We've got some fun things.
Did she write your blueberry story?
She wrote the blueberry story with Robert Frost.
And that was great too.
Yeah.
I enjoyed your beekeeping story too.
Oh,
that
Jeffrey,
was
thank you for mentioning that. Jeffrey Hamelman wrote an incredible story about beekeeping.
Yeah, it was a great story. But also the photographs. Well, all the photographs in the magazine are so beautiful, but the beekeeping photographs really made me stop and look.
Well, that will make my husband very happy, because he, even though he has another life for a hobby, he takes a lot of the photos for me, and that's been very nice. And he did take those beekeeping photos, and the relevance there is that he's actually allergic to bees, but he was willing to suit up and get right up to that hive and take those photos.
That's nerve-wracking. Wow.
That's kind of fun. And look for the winter issue, because he's got some great shots in there of some interesting things as well.
Okay.
That were equally challenging.
All right. Who is the publication's audience mainly at this point, do you think?
We seem to be anyone who loves Vermont and loves food in Vermont. I remember when I first received, having a marketing background, and I first looked at some materials from Edible, and they said something about the demographics being 18 to 80 or something, and I thought, sure. But actually, I think that's right. Mm. I mean, they're really, it really seems, there's a lot of young people interested, and of course I think that's partially because of UVM and all the work they're doing with food systems and sustainability.
Right.
And so I think we have a unique population here in Vermont. I think that we have an audience interested in every age range, because we have a population that's taught from, I mean, in school now, right? They're getting to eat local food and learn about that. And there's a lot of high school teachers and even grade school and junior high teachers who are starting to use food in their curriculum as a way to demonstrate a lot of these scientific principles.
Mm.
And lunchrooms are starting to bring in food from local farmers. So I think our audience really is at the you know, I'm sort of at the risk of sounding uninformed or you know, really trying to just sell you or something, but really it's true.
It's everybody.
It's everybody.
How about people outside of Vermont? Do you have subscribers who have moved away?
Or? Yes, we do. We have subscribers who have moved away. We have people who have visited and fallen in love with it. We have folks who've had a connection to Vermont and now it's gone. We have chefs who know what's going on with the food movement here and they want to stay on top of it.
Mm.
So the subscribers tend to be from all over. A lot of Canadians, really interesting. There's a lot of Canadian subscribers in the sort of Quebec, Montreal area.
Mm-hmm. How do you measure the magazine's success?
I've actually thought a lot about that question, because in business, and this is a business, even though it's something I enjoy doing, success is measured by profits. I'm not successful in that, but, you know, by that measure, we're not yet profitable. We're a new business. We're in a state with 650,000 people. It's been challenging to get the support. I don't think it's because people don't want to be supportive. We have limited resources here. So, you know, from that measure, it's not a success. However, if I judge by the emails that I get, the response I get when people hear what I do, a lot of the feedback that the stories bring, that the writers write to me about what happens to them when they run into someone who's read their story, I'd say we're very successful. We've been very successful at creating an interest and excitement about this aspect of life and living in Vermont.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So, but I don't think I'll feel completely content until we can get that gap to narrow. Because I do think that's the vote. That's going to be the community's vote, saying this really matters to us or not.
Okay.
So we'll give it some time.
Now, having brought up the finances,
mm-hmm.
how is the magazine supported? Obviously, you've made a personal commitment.
Mm-hmm.
There are subscriptions. There are advertisers. Do you fundraise? Do you write for grants? Any of that?
I don't. And I've wondered about grants, but being a for-profit, I don't know that that's available. I have a very strong personal interest in philanthropy, and through my corporate work was introduced to what philanthropy can do on significant levels. And so I've often wondered, should Edible Green Mountains become a not-for-profit? But I don't know that we could really do that because of our relationship with Edible Communities. That said, Edible Portland, that first magazine that caught my attention, is published by something called EcoTrust. EcoTrust is a nonprofit, and I think the way this would work best is if we had a large enough organization in our state for whom this could be the marketing arm, the way it works in Portland, that would be fantastic.
Okay.
And so, I wish there were an opportunity like that, but I don't think there is. But if you think of one or your listeners think of one, I'm really open to suggestions on that.
Okay.
Because pretty much it's the advertisers and everything you said.
I want to talk about the locavore movement.
Can people in Vermont live just on local foods and what they grow themselves year-round?
I think they can if they want to make those choices. I mean, just the way somebody becomes a vegetarian or somebody becomes a vegan, they make a decision to live their life with the absence of certain things and the inclusion of others. And I think that it takes planning and foresight. I think it probably takes community. When I think of really successful locavores and the locavore movements that are working so well in our state, Robin McDermott, who's one of the co-founders of the Mad River Valley Locavores, is just incredible. If you look at the programming that she does and the types of events that they offer for learning how to can, learning how to preserve, the winter farmers market that they've put together. We have so many more winter markets than we did 3 or 4 years mm-hmm. ago. And there's a lot of storage vegetables available. In the winter issue, you'll read about Rockville Market Farm. There's going to be squash all year because of what they're able to do. So there's certain things we don't grow in Vermont at any time. Lemons, oranges, limes. A true locavore may say, I'm not even going to eat those in the summer. I'm not going to eat them ever. Then there's other people who have what they call the Marco Polo exception. So they decide that they can have coffee. The things that Marco Polo, during those days that might have been brought over on the spice route. So they're willing to use vanilla if they're baking, or cinnamon, or use olive oil in their cooking and things like that. I sort of define it differently for myself. I'm trying hard not to buy anything that's produced outside of the United States the best I can, especially if there's an option of it produced in the United States. I try to mostly eat fruit in season, but have succumbed to the occasional citrus.
And banana.
I personally, but my husband likes a banana now and then. And I love great olive oil and certain things that come from other places. And I also think my interest in food goes beyond Vermont's food to sort of the food world in general. And I think a lot of what we're doing in Vermont is informed by other cultures and traditions, like in Italy and France. And so experiencing those and tasting and comparing isn't a bad thing.
Mm-hmm.
But whenever possible, I try to do what I can to build the local economy.
Mm-hmm. And it seems that just producing this magazine does a lot for that, too.
I'm hoping so.
Can you talk a little bit about Heritage Radio and your role in that aspect of Edible Communities?
Absolutely. Heritage Radio was founded by Heritage Foods, and Heritage Foods was founded by Patrick Martins. He was one of the original members of the slow food community in the United States. And as a result, as I understand it, of his work with slow food, he decided he wanted to invest everything, his heart and soul, in bringing back heritage breeds. So they had a very successful year this year. They've really turned raising heritage breed turkeys. And Frank Reese is one of the first farmers who laid his life on the line to do that. You have to eat them to save them is his tagline. So he was able to bring back these extinct breeds of birds that people were eating in our country long before the Purdues and the Tysons and those folks came along and domesticated the poultry and turned it into, something with really big breasts because people liked white meat and they were growing at 3 or 4 times their rate. So instead of, and I don't want to be quoted on this because I don't know how long a heritage breed lives. I don't know if it's 9 months but whatever it is, it takes about a third or half that amount of time to raise a bird in a what we now consider conventional farming type way. So Heritage Foods does that not only with turkeys, but with heritage breeds of pork and heritage breeds of beef and lamb and these incredible pawpaws, which they sent some to me this summer. And Charlie Nardozzi, who I'm sure a lot of your listeners mm-hmm. know, he's a very well-known gardening expert in our state and around the country, national spokesperson for the National Gardening Association. He spent some time with me on my radio show for Heritage, and when they offered to want to send us something as a thank you, and they were going to send us some pork, Charlie said, well, I'm a vegetarian. So they sent us these pawpaws, and it's this incredible fruit that tastes sort of like all those things we've decided we can't have here, you know, a banana and a papaya and a little bit of a melon, which we of course do raise. But so they've done some incredible things. Well, Patrick, being very forward-thinking and being a very young group over there with lots of energy, decided that starting a radio network, an internet-based radio network that could foster communication, discussion, education, and entertainment all about this movement and what they're trying to do would be a great marketing tool. So he reached out to Edible Communities, and there were three of us, three publishers that said, sure, we'll sign up. And this is another one of those how do you measure success things. There's no money changing hands. This is all labor of love, and just that we're all really committed to this type of work. And as you know, it's a lot of fun to be on the radio and talk to people.
Yeah, so the Radiator's the same way. It's a labor of love.
Yeah, for all of us. But it's I think, something when we talked about those values, right? It's just something we believe in, and you know, it's a great way to be able to share.
Right. Now, how do people find Heritage Radio programs?
Heritage Radio, is it heritageradionetwork.com? I believe it's heritageradionetwork.com.
Okay.
And if you do a search and put in Heritage Radio Network, there's one other network with the name Heritage out of somewhere in Eastern Europe or something. But it's pretty easy to know that you're at heritageradionetwork.com because you'll see Edible Communities in the little search cloud that they have. And Patrick's name and a lot of other stuff. They have some great programming. They have wonderful programming about cheeses, and they've had wines and farmers, and it's a great site. And there's a lot of emerging. Edible Radio is going to start. Edible Communities is going to start a radio station. I'm finding that radio seems to be the next frontier. Internet radio seems to be the next frontier for communicating these messages about food and our community. And there's a lot of popular back and forth. I think people were getting tired of not hearing voices and just assuming voices when they were reading things and mm-hmm. all these emails and blogs, and so now people are seeming to want to put the voice and
put more
sort
of an audio
heart
component online.
Yeah, yeah, I think so.
Okay. Now, speaking of online, I noticed that the website for Edible Green Mountains offers a lot of content from each issue.
Mm-hmm.
How much of the full publication is accessible online?
The websites, I should say, for anyone who rushes out to look at it, the website's being upgraded.
Okay.
So it's being upgraded to a new operating system that'll allow us to do even more and make it more interactive. I mean, as you know, progress in the web world is just beyond the speed of light. I don't know what's faster than that, but it's at the fastest thing possible, and things get outdated so quickly, so we're upgrading it so that it can be a lot more relevant. To answer your question directly, so up until now, the whole issue's been available, but I've tried to delay it. So if you went there today, the fall issue isn't up yet, because I feel that if someone's subscribing, they should get value for that. They shouldn't have something that is available to everyone right away. I think in the future what I'd like to do is tease with just a couple of stories and encourage people to pick up the magazine or subscribe in order to get the full content. So that's the direction we'll be going in.
Mm-hmm.
We just haven't had that capability yet.
Okay. Outside of the writers and the editors who are doing the work on the magazine, do you use any other volunteers or people who are helping out to get it out to the public?
Not really.
Okay.
There's times where people will come. I try to go to a lot of events and things, especially in the summer and fall and spring. So sometimes people will volunteer to be at the table with me or mm-hmm. something. But I'm open to suggestions.
So you go to events in order to market the magazine and
yes.
to make it present within relevant.
Right. So something like the Vermont Fresh Network Forum or Valley Food and Farm, sort of in the middle southern part of the state, does a great event. You know, try to go there. I don't have anything edible, so I always try to find an advertiser or someone with something delicious and edible to give away, which is kind of fun. And I also want to show my support. I mean, I see it as a very collaborative, two-way relationship. Mm-hmm. You know, it's not all about give us. It's about what we can also give and offer to you.
Right.
So that's another reason for doing that.
What are some of your favorite magazines outside of this?
Such a junkie. I shouldn't say that. I mean, I'm a magazine and cookbook junkie. I really like Sevre a lot. Mm-hmm. And I love Fine Cooking. I think that's another great one. There's something new called Canal House that people may not be familiar with yet. It's two women that have done a lot of work for Sevre. One was, I believe, one of the founding editors of Sevre, and is an incredible photographer. And her first name is Christopher. So you may think it's a man, but it's a woman, just as Christopher Coutant, who writes for us, is a woman. And it's a really interesting concept. It's a cookbook that's going to come out 3 times a year. So I don't know if anyone remembers the Time Life series. Mm-hmm. There was this incredible Time Life series
on photography.
They had photography, they had food, and the food one was, there'd be a dairy, and then there'd be eggs, and then there'd be pork. And well, this is a little different than that in that it's seasonal, and they're doing 3 of them. So I'm really impressed with those. I like them a lot. I love The New Yorker, even though that's not always about food. Pretty much anything. I love all kinds of magazines. Mm-hmm. And I learn a lot when I read them. I mean, there's a lot out there. Coastal Living. Living here in Vermont, I need to get a little taste of the ocean every now and then.
Right. Do you write outside of your work with the magazine?
I don't as much as I'd like, and I'm finding at the beginning of the magazine I was writing more, and now I find that I'm always the one whose story's late, who hasn't done my editor's letter, and it's just too painful for everyone, I think. Even though I would like to write more, and I certainly thought that the magazine would be an opportunity and a forum for that. And so a goal of mine is to organize myself better so I could do more of that. I have a couple stories I'd like to write for 2010, so I need to make that happen. Mm-hmm. And I'd also like to become a better writer. I'm not sure I'm the best. I really admire a lot of the people who write for me, and I think that there's always something to strive for.
Do you find that your copy editors are nervous about editing your stuff?
I don't think so. I mean, I think I invite them not to be. And I don't think so. I don't know what they would say if you asked them, but I would hope not. I think maybe they've been gentler than they might have been if it was an anonymous thing, because it's true, a lot of what they edit, they don't know the people.
Right.
They're just editing it. And so maybe they're a little more careful. But I hope not, because then I don't think I'd learn.
If you were going to give one piece of advice to someone who was thinking about starting a magazine, what would it be?
One piece of advice. Just one.
Just one.
Well, I guess I have to preface it. I think you need to know why you're doing it, first of all. And, of course, if we're talking about an endeavor that it needs to have a financial gain, I would say really look into the market and your competition and make sure that there's a reason to do this in print, because so many magazines are folding and doing things online now. A lot of the content's available online. So I would say that if you have a niche, apparently edibles are thriving, and ours is. I'm happy to say that our ad revenue is more each season, even though we're not quite where we want or need to be. We've always grown, and so I think that's an indication that what we're doing has value and meaning, and part of that is because we're not only a niche publication, but we're very focused on a particular place. So we do provide, I hope, some level of information and insight that you don't get in a broader publication. You might get one story about Vermont in Sevre, but you're not going to get 4 seasons of stories about Vermont in Sevre. Mm-hmm. And so I think I'd really look at what your topic is, make sure you have a lot of passion, a lot of energy for it, and then how can you focus it so that you really offer the reader in the community something that they're not going to get somewhere else in that package.
Okay.
So I think that's what I'd say.
Great. Thank you.
How do you market the publication?
As I said, I try to go to these events. I participate in a lot of things related to topics that matter to us so that people get to know us that way, whether it's through Vermont Fresh Network or other things that are going on around sustainability in the state. I try to be somewhat visible, hoping it's a way that I can make the magazine visible. Mm-hmm. And we have done some advertising, very minimal, but a little bit of advertising in publications or in program booklets connected to events around the state that might offer us some opportunities. I really haven't gone head first into the whole social networking mode or that type of thing. And there's different feelings about that. You know, I know that tweeting can be really helpful and Facebook and all those things. It's a little hard because I feel my plate's pretty full now, keeping up with what I have. I've thought about a blog. I've thought about a newsletter. And those are all things we'd like to initiate once we get our site to where we need it to be. Mm-hmm. So I think that would help.
Yeah. When you get stuck in your work or have trouble moving forward with a piece of writing, what do you do, or what do you recommend people do?
Call someone. No. Actually, I had a very hard time with my editor's letter. Well, I'll say two things. So first, I'd say I had a very hard time with my editor's letter at this issue because I feel very self-conscious. I feel like, why do people want to hear from me? What could I possibly say that's more important than what so many of our writers could say? Let's give them the page. And on the other hand, I want it to be a place to express my gratitude for the support that we've been getting and to share with people some of the excitement about what's coming. But I was very stuck this issue, and my designer was great. And so she sort of mocked up her thoughts about what I might want to say, and that gave me a jumping off point because I was pretty stuck on that one. But the other thing I'll do, and maybe other writers do this, is I actually try to get very quiet and sort of meditate on it. I mean, really sort of say to myself or ask myself, what is my purpose? What is it I want the person to feel or convey? And then, you know, universe, muse, whoever, please inspire me to find a way to do that. So I do try to slow down. And I find when I can't, that's when nothing's coming.
Okay. Well, thank you very much for talking with
me. Oh, absolutely.
I hope you enjoyed that conversation with Deborah Shapiro, who is not related to me, by the way. Next week, tune in to hear a talk with Diane Imrie and Richard Jarmus, authors of the new cookbook, Cooking Close to Home. Write the Book is brought to you in part by Autism Support Daily, Vermont's first online support group and host of the annual Autism Walk each October at Battery Park. More information is available at autismsupportdaily.com or 802-985-8773. And by the Lake Champlain Regional Chamber of Commerce, promoting and supporting a healthy environment that makes Burlington the ideal place to live, work, visit, and do business, located at 60 Main Street in Burlington and online at vermont.org. And by Vermont Businesses for Social Responsibility, building a brand new economy with old-fashioned values. Learn more at vbsr.org. And by Burlington Telecom, providing Burlington with access to the world, internet, television, telephone, burlingtontelecom.com, Burlington's fiber optic network. Here's the Bookworm's calendar for the week. The Northshire Bookstore in Manchester Center presents Ken Burns discussing the National Parks, America's Best Idea, the companion book to his recent PBS series, at the Equinox Hotel in Manchester, Tuesday, December 15th at 7. More information is available at 802-362-2200 or 800-437-3700. Phoenix Books and Cafe in Essex presents Inga Schaefer discussing and signing copies of her new book, Chronicles of Colchester, Thursday, December 17th at 6:30. The Dorothy Alling Memorial Library presents its Brown Bag Book Club, Friday, December 18th, 12:30 to 1:30. This month's discussion centers around the book Snow in August by Pete Hamill. More information is available at 802-878-4918. Local author John Katz will be discussing and signing copies of his books. He has written 14 books. at the North Shire Bookstore from 1 to 3 on Saturday, December 19th. And author and radio commentator Willem Lang and illustrator Bert Dodson will present their Christmas folktale for children, Favor Johnson, A Christmas Story, Sunday, December 20th at 1 at the North Shire Bookstore in Manchester. This week's guest, Deborah Shapiro, actually recommended two Write the Book prompts for listeners. They're great, and since we have time, I'm going to include them both. Your first prompt this week has to do with recipes. Look at recipes and notice how they're written. You can look in cookbooks, magazines, your own index card file. Notice actual differences in recipes' structure and try to understand what the cooks who wrote them were focused on. Was it ease of use or quick communication or tips for success? Did your grandmother guess at average quantities in her recipes, or did she keep to very specific measurements? Does a certain famous chef in a cookbook that you have suggest where you might find little-known ingredients? Does your favorite magazine offer variations or keep to a set script in the recipes they provide? Some recipes are copied down as single paragraphs with ingredients embedded in the text. And in others, ingredients are offered up front. Some are written in two columns with ingredients on the left and instructions on the right. Edible Green Mountains magazine delineates each step with a new paragraph indent in hopes of keeping things simple. So study recipes, and afterward write a scene or a poem that attempts to emulate something about a recipe that you found. Then write it again using another style of recipe for basic inspiration. What differs in your final products? Which do you prefer and why? So that was the first prompt. And the second prompt suggested by Deborah also has two parts. First, consider a food memory. When Deborah was small, she would occasionally come home from school to find her mother in the kitchen making a Hungarian biscotti-like cookie. And she recalls the warming scent of cinnamon, the crunch of cinnamon and sugar on top of the finished cookies, the glass of milk. All of these sensory memories evoke strong emotions for her as she thinks back to her childhood. So identify a food memory of your own. And then consider a food-related poem or scene that moved you in a work of literature. There's the poem Blueberries by Robert Frost. There are Proust's famous Madeleines. Just about every chapter in Like Water for Chocolate has some sort of wonderful food-related scene. So find one that speaks to you and decide why the scene or poem affected you as it did. If you were to try and write a food scene or poem of your own, what might you have learned from this work of literature that would help you? Once you've thought about all these things, then sit down and try to write about your own food memory. Copies of these two prompts will be included in the description to this week's podcast. Good luck with these exercises, and please listen next week for another. If you're interested in sharing this show with out-of-town friends, let them know they can stream it live at theradiator.org every Monday from 2 to 3. Archived episodes of Write the Book are available on iTunes and at writethebook.podbean.com as free podcasts. Upcoming episodes of the show are often announced in my blog, writethebook.wordpress.com. And a reminder, if you have comments about the show or news about book-related events, please send an email to writethebook@gmail.com. This station is able to bring you shows like Write the Book thanks to community support and involvement. More information about The Radiator is available online at theradiator.org. Stay tuned. Cheryl Willoughby brings you The World of Music at 3 o'clock. This has been Write the Book. I'm Shayla Shapiro, and you are listening to The Radiator, 105.9 FM, WOMMLP, Burlington, Vermont.